Welcome back to The Source on KSTX 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. This is a story that, if it were fiction, it would seem too incredible for the suspension of belief. A former Texas slave disguises himself as a successful Mexican businessman, goes to New York, becomes the toast of the town, hangs out with Teddy Roosevelt, influences U.S.-Mexico relations. He's a big shot, but then he is forgotten due to the forces of time and history. It's all a true story written by Carl Jacoby. He's Jacoby. The book is The Strange Career of William Ellis, the Texas slave who became a Mexican millionaire. And Carl, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
How did you come across this story?
Oh, it's a long story. I mean, I started almost 20 years ago. I was in graduate school then, and I was looking through some records of the State Department, and I found some references to a mass migration of hundreds of African-American sharecroppers from mainly Alabama and Georgia who were heading down to northern Mexico, to Coahuila and Durango in 1895. And this just stunned me, because whenever we talk about migration between the U.S. and Mexico, we're always talking about migration from Mexico to the United States, right? And what really struck me here was, why is it that all of a sudden people in the 1895 were thinking about Mexico, not the U.S., as the land of opportunity? I mean, it does make sense when you think about what African Americans were going through in the 1890s, as sort of the collapse of Reconstruction and the rise of Jim Crow.
A lot of lynching.
Yes, exactly. And so this was just a fascinating incident. And what really intrigued me was who had set this in motion. There were references to this person named William Ellis as being the mastermind behind this plot. And at the time, I couldn't really figure out who this person was, because there were a lot of very vague stories floating around about him. And so it took me, as you can see, almost two decades to finally unravel his life story. And in many respects, that's because he was trying to hide so many aspects of his own history. Often when you're studying history, you know, if it's someone like Thomas Jefferson, you collect everything about that particular person, and there's a big library that sits there, and it's very easy to figure out what's going on with that individual. But William Ellis was someone who was doing the reverse, who was trying to make sure that he left as few tracks as possible. And so it took a lot of historical sleuthing on my part to actually figure out who this remarkable figure is, who would do something like this, think about bringing African Americans in large numbers to Mexico. And that's really only one of the remarkable things that he did during his lifetime.
Well, for someone who was trying to leave as few tracks as possible, he was frequently quoted in the New York Times in discussions about U.S.-Mexico relations. And also when he died, he had obituaries in all the major newspapers.
Yes, no, that's true. I mean, it's one of the great paradoxes. He's trying to leave his few traces because he was, the way he was presenting himself, which was a very successful Mexican entrepreneur, and the way that he had been born, which is as an enslaved African American in South Texas and Victoria, were so far apart from one another. And in many ways, to achieve what he wanted to achieve, it was incredibly difficult for him to do that as an African American. So, and there were more opportunities for him to achieve what he wanted to achieve as a Mexican. But the irony, of course, is that the more that he achieved, the more attention that he received, and the greater the risk was that he might actually be revealed.
And he would be revealed. What would be the revelation?
Well, the revelation would be that he wasn't. So he often went by the name. His birth name was William Henry Ellis. He often went by the name Guillermo Enrique Eliseo, which is basically translating his name into Spanish, even though Eliseo is more of a first name in Spanish rather than a last name. And so what would happen is that he would be revealed not to be a Mexican, but to be an African-American. And this was crucial in the Texas of the 1880s and 1890s, because he was someone who was getting access to whites-only hotels and to whites-only Pullman cars and doing business with, elite white figures. And none of these people would give him the time of day if they found out that he was African-American.
But he still, I mean, you write about then he was at times subjected to Jim Crow laws.
Yeah, he is, what's really fascinating about him is that often, sometimes when people are doing what, passing as a different race, when African-Americans pass as a member of a different race, often what they have to do is really cut themselves off from a lot of their birth community. And William Ellis didn't do that. And so I describe in the book that really what I see him doing more as, instead of passing, which is sort of leaving behind one identity and taking on another one. He's doing what I call code shifting, which is that he's moving back and forth between these identities, because he's always very interested in politics, in originally in Texas, so that he's a follower of Norris Wright Cooney, who some of your listeners may know was a very important figure in the Texas Republican Party, the most powerful African-American in the Texas Republican Party, or in fact in the Republican Party in general in the 19th century. And so he's always he's engaged in all these risky activities, which is to say that not only is he trying to pretend he's not African-American at one moment, but at other moments he's actually deeply immersed in African-American politics.
He must have had an incredible brain.
I think so. I mean, these are the things that it's hard to measure, but I think he was incredibly smart for someone who came, was born on a cotton plantation in Victoria, Texas. And he also, I think, had tremendous self-assurance and self-command. And I think he also probably had tremendous charisma, because he's able to persuade all of these people that he is who he says he is. And people, they want to be persuaded. They want to believe him. And he really knows how to play to his audience. I think he's really just sort of a master showman. But I think you're right, it all starts, he has to be able to think of these schemes. And what's really remarkable about him is he's able to look at the evolving world of the U.S.-Mexico border in the 19th century, and he's able to see all these new opportunities there that a lot of other people at the time didn't see.
And this comes at a time when Mexico was trying to open itself up and become modernized.
Right. I mean, I think that's a very much part of the story as well. I mean, really, one thing that I'm trying to do in the book is bring together Mexican and U.S. history, and both Mexico and the U.S. are dealing with these national crises. The U.S. has just, of course, gone through the Civil War and is dealing with emancipation and Reconstruction. What does that really mean? Is there possible to make a real, lasting, meaningful freedom for African Americans? Mexico has just gone through the French intervention, which is like a civil war of sorts, and they're trying to figure out how can they become a strong, unified nation that can withstand invasions from people like France or potentially from the United States. And one way that Mexico decides to do this is that they open up Mexico to foreign investment, particularly from the U.S., to try to build up its economy to make it a stronger economy so that they're able to be more modern. And Ellis, in many ways, is able to sell this fantasy of being able to invest in Mexico to American investors. During the Gilded Age, it's this great boom in American consumer items, and almost everything in the that Americans wanted, in one way or another, was tied to Mexico, so that the car is beginning to take off, and cars depended on rubber from Mexico. They depended on petroleum from Mexico. Electrification is beginning to happen, and so...
So we need copper.
Copper wire, that all comes from Mexico. Telephone, you also need the copper wire from Mexico. And then once you have electrification, you can even have things like refrigeration, which means you can have ice cream. And if you want to have vanilla or chocolate ice cream, vanilla or chocolate all comes from Mexico. And so there's the tremendous mania for investing in Mexico. I think of it a little bit like the Silicon Valley of today.
Right, but this was all pre-Mexican Revolution, and we'll talk about that some more, and how just the existence of William Ellis was a challenge to all of the ideas that supported and backed Jim Crow, and which was the backbone of life in the South. We're going to continue the conversation. This is The Source on KSTX. Call in 210-614-8980. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Juneteenth is coming up, and it's an opportunity to take a look at one interesting former Texas slave who went on to become a Mexican millionaire. It's the strange career of William Ellis, and we're joined by the author. He's Columbia University professor of history, Carl Jacoby. I mean, and so you write about Juneteenth a little bit in the book. Why is that significant?
Well, Juneteenth, of course, as I'm sure all your listeners know, that's June 19th, 1865. This is when Union forces land in Texas, and it's the beginning of emancipation in Texas. Texas has a really fascinating Civil War experience, which is to say that because it's so far west, that it isn't a theater for the war in the same way that Virginia is and everything else. And so that one of the things that had been a possibility in places like Virginia, which is that slaves can run off to Union lines and self-emancipate, that isn't a possibility in Texas. In fact, slavery, if anything, becomes more entrenched in Texas during the Civil War. A lot of Southern planters actually bring their slaves to Texas because they want to protect them from exactly that happening, from their ability to run off. And so it's this real moment when you have the Union forces landing and trying to finally bring emancipation and freedom to Texas, which is, it's been delayed. This is almost a year and a half after the Emancipation Proclamation, but really nothing has changed in terms of slavery in Texas until Granger's arrival on June 19th.
William Ellis going to Mexico, you know, Mexico in and of itself is not a country that is without prejudice, particularly against African descendants.
No, yes, that's definitely true. I think both countries have complicated and difficult and fraught relationships with race, but in very different ways. One of the things that I think is very interesting about this time period is that the United States is moving towards this embrace of racial purity, so that you see after Reconstruction really emerge very clearly the one drop law. I mean, as a matter of fact, in the 1860s in Texas, if you had less than one black great-grandparent, you were considered white. So you could have black ancestry and still be considered white, and that eventually shifts. At the same time, Mexico is actually moving towards this celebration of mixing or mestizaje. And so it's very interesting. One is very interested about racial purity, where you'll separate out the races and confine African Americans to the status of second-class citizens. Mexico is all about, on the face of it, it's about mixing, which seems more inclusive. But the way they define mestizaje is between Spanish and Indian primarily. And what happens is that Mexico actually had its own history of slavery, although it does get rid of slavery before the United States. It does have Afro-Mexicanos, people of African descent who live in Mexico. But they're completely erased by this image of mestizaje, so that everyone is seen as a mestizo, but it doesn't really actually acknowledge the reality of some sort of African ancestry. So each country is racist, but in its own unique way.
And you see, like on the coast, the Caribbean coast of Mexico, quite a bit of the Afro-Mexicano culture there, which is stands out from other parts of Mexico.
Yes, no, the so-called Costa Chica, which would be in Guerrero and Oaxaca, and then along Veracruz, as you were talking, are the areas now where there's been a lot of work by contemporary anthropologists looking at Afro-Mexicanos. One of the things I think the book does, which is it really, there's this big gap in the history, what we know about the history of Mexico, which is to say we know a fair amount about people of African descent during the colonial period. Then after independence, Mexico stops reporting people by race. It's very hard to track people. And then we know recent research that's being done by anthropologists in these coastal areas. And so the 19th century is really this big unanswered question. And what William Ellis's story does, which is really valuable for our understanding of Mexican history, is that he really brings to the surface all these debates in Mexico about whether peoples of African descent, and particularly African Americans, can or cannot be members of the Mexican national community.
He found this amazing avatar to explore a history that has sort of been sidelined as we talk about, what happened in the Gilded Age and with Mexico. And it must have been amazing for you to do all this research. And a lot of it is original, firsthand research. No one had gone there before.
No, I mean, I'd say almost all of it is. There have been a few little references to William Ellis here and there, I think often people not even knowing his background. For me, what really broke the story wide open was the fact that I was ultimately able to track down some of his descendants, some of his family members, both the American side of his family, which had moved. They were originally from Victoria, then they moved to San Antonio, and then during the 1920s, during the so-called Great Migration, a lot of them moved to Los Angeles. And I also was able to track down the Mexican side of the family. This would be William Ellis's grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And the two sides of the family had actually lost touch with one another. So in the afterword of the book, I talk about bringing them back together, and they're able to finally, a century later, have this family reunion and reconnect the family circle.
So you write a little bit about this. Talk about San Antonio post-Civil War and what it meant for African-Americans here.
Well, so San Antonio, after Civil War, let's see, the San Antonio occupies this really important place as the hub for trade between northern Mexico, particularly Monterrey, and the United States, San Antonio. And this only strengthens once the railroad comes in around the 1880s. And it's a city that at the time had fairly small African-American population, about 15% of the community, and was generally seen as not as extreme in its treatment of African-Americans as some other Texas cities. But still, you can see a lot of the jobs that African-Americans took in San Antonio in the 19th century were so-called Negro jobs, which were jobs that were confined to African-Americans, were often jobs that would have been done by slaves in the antebellum period. And so William Ellis is the only member of his family who decides to pass as Mexican. And he has a sort of front row seat on what happens if you don't do that, which is to say his father and his brother work very menial jobs by and large. And I think he thinks that either I can be African-American and be confined to this very menial existence, or if I'm able to persuade people that I'm Mexican, I actually, things open up for me in a whole new, different way.
And he's able to do that because he speaks Spanish so well.
Yeah, so he's, obviously I've never spoken Spanish with William Ellis, which would of course be one of the things I would love to do in terms of getting a sense of exactly how he spoke, but I have a lot of letters that he wrote in Spanish, and it's beautiful, flowing, flawless Spanish. He had grown up in Victoria, as I said, which is sort of the very outer fringe of the Cotton Kingdom during the antebellum period. And during the cotton picking season, which is really when there's the great demand for labor in the cotton plantations, often a lot of these plantations in southern Texas would hire on as day laborers, Tejanos, to help pick the cotton. And so it seems that in these interactions that he had with Tejanos as a young boy picking cotton, that then this grew, this allowed him to speak Spanish. And then once he was able to speak Spanish, this whole new world opens up for him of Mexico and also integrating himself into the Tejano community.
But he had to learn high Spanish, you know, not the Spanish of the working class, but of the upper class.
Well, no, that's true. I mean, because when he's presenting himself as a Mexican, and that's a great question, he's not trying to present himself as a campesino, as a peón. He's trying to present himself as ultimately a member of the Porfirian elite from Mexico City. So the way he dresses is very elegant. He lives, he has an office in the right near the Zocalo in Mexico City. And so he's presenting himself as ultimately a very cultured Mexican. And I think that's part of what's going on. He's not simply passing a racial line, so to speak, between being African-American and being Mexican. He's also passing a class line, which is to say, you know, he was born a slave, very impoverished circumstances, but he's actually trying to present himself as someone from the upper class Porfirian elite.
So he apparently had it made while he was in Mexico. Why did he come back to the United States and go to New York, risk it all?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, I've often asked myself, he could just have stayed in Mexico and settled there. I think really it has to do with the sort of the investment frenzy of the time period, which is directed from the U.S. towards Mexico. And in order to harness that and direct that and profit from that, he actually had to spend part of his time in New York. So he's about half the time in New York City and about half the time in Mexico City. And I think that's really the solution there, that if he had just been in Mexico and hadn't been able to engage with Wall Street, I mean, he ultimately moves to Wall Street. He's arguably the first African-American on Wall Street, although, of course, most people at the time didn't know that he was African-American.
And so he had to speak English at times, and I guess he spoke with the fake Spanish accent?
It's interesting. Newspaper reports say he speaks pretty good English for a Mexican. So I guess he must have had to, try to fake it to that extent. But again, what I think is fascinating is two things are going on. First, in contrast with San Antonio, when he's in New York City, where he lives the last about quarter century of his life, there's very few Mexicans in New York City at that time period. In 1900, there are only something like 200 Mexicans in all of New York City. So most people in Manhattan had never met a Mexican. So he's completely free in a way that he hadn't been in San Antonio to invent what it means to be Mexican, because these people had no way of checking up on him. And so that's one of the things that's going on.
And so what do you think is the takeaway from the story, other than this fascinating chameleon-like character who was able to reinvent himself? What is William Ellis telling us today?
There's a couple of things. I mean, one thing is that I think he shows how intimately intertwined U.S. and Mexican history are, that we often don't think about these deep connections. But actually, the Civil War in the U.S. and the French intervention in Mexico and Reconstruction in the U.S.
And American intervention in Mexico.
Right, exactly. These are all very deeply bound up with one another. The other thing I think that's really fascinating about William Ellis is that he shows both the rigidity and the fragility of the emerging Jim Crow system. So you can see how much people in Texas and throughout the South are really, and to be honest, also in New York City, are trying to impose segregation, and how much they're really trying to keep the races separate from one another. And this is the way of how are they going to cope after the Civil War with the emancipation of African Americans.
All right, I got to cut you off. We're done. Carl Jacoby is the author, history professor, Columbia University. The book is The Strange Career of William Ellis, a Texas slave who became a Mexican millionaire. And this is The Source on KSTX.